halfway up Visenya's hill to the inn that Murillo had suggested. It was a rambling old place on Eel Alley. The woman who owned it was a sour crone, with a wandering eye, who looked them over suspiciously and bit the coin that Catelyn offered her to make sure it was real. Her rooms were large and airy, though, and Murillo swore that her fish stew was the most savoury in all the Seven Kingdoms. Best of all, she had no interest in their names. "I think it's best if you stay away from the common room," Sir Roderick said, after they have settled in. "Even in a place like this, one never knows who may be watching." He wore ringmail, dagger, and longsword under a dark cloak with a hood he could pull up over his head. "I will be back before nightfall with Sir Aaron," he promised. "Rest now, my lady." Catelyn was tired. The journey had been long and fatiguing, and she was no longer as young as she had been. Her windows opened on the alley and rooftops, with a view of the Blackwater beyond. She watched Sir Roderick set off, striding briskly through the busy streets until he was lost in the crowds, then decided to take his advice. The bedding was stuffed with straw instead of feathers, but she had no trouble falling asleep. She woke to a pounding on her door. Catelyn sat up sharply. Outside the window, the rooftops of King's Landing were red in the light of the setting sun. She had slept longer than she intended. A fist hammered at her door again, and a voice called out, "Open, in the name of the king!" "A moment," she called out. She wrapped herself in her cloak. The dagger was on the bedside table. She snatched it up before she unlatched the heavy wooden door. The men who pushed into the room wore the black ringmail and golden cloaks of the city watch. Their leader smiled at the dagger in her hand and said, "No need for that, milady. We're to escort you to the castle." "By whose authority?" she asked. He showed her a ribbon. Catelyn felt her breath catch in her throat. The seal was a mockingbird in grey wax. "Pataya," she said. "So soon? Something must have happened to Sir Roderick." She looked at the head guardsman. "Do you know who I am?" "No, milady," he said. "My lord Littlefinger said only to bring you to him and see that you were not mistreated." Catelyn nodded. "You may wait outside while I dress." She bathed her hands in the basin and wrapped them in clean linen. Her fingers were thick and awkward as she struggled to lace up her bodice and knot a drab brown cloak about her neck. How could Littlefinger have known she was here? Sir Roderick would never have told him. Old he might be, but he was stubborn and loyal to a fault. Were they too late? Had the Lannisters reached King's Landing before her? No. If that were true, Ned would be here too, and surely he would have come to her. How? Then she thought, Murillo, the Tyroshi, knew who they were and where they were. Damn him. She hoped he'd gotten a good price for the information. They had brought a horse for her. The lamps were being lit along the streets as they set out, and Catelyn felt the eyes of the city on her as she rode, surrounded by the guard in their golden cloaks. When they reached the Red Keep, the portcullis was down and the great gates sealed for the night, but the castle windows were alive with flickering lights. The guardsmen left their mounts outside the walls and escorted her through a narrow postern door, then up endless steps to a tower. He was alone in the room, seated at a heavy wooden table, an oil lamp beside him as he wrote. When they ushered her inside, he set down his pen and looked at her. "Cat," he said quietly. "Why have I been brought here in this fashion?" He rose and gestured brusquely to the guards. "Leave us." The men departed. "You were not mistreated, I trust," he said after they had gone. "I gave firm instructions." He noticed her bandages. "Oh, your hands." Catelyn ignored the implied question. "I am not accustomed to being summoned like a serving wench," she said icily. "As a boy, You still knew the meaning of courtesy.
I've angered you, my lady. That was never my intent.
He looked contrite. The look brought back vivid memories for Catelyn. He'd been a sly child, but after his mischiefs he always looked contrite. It was a gift he had. The years had not changed him much. Patar had been a small boy, and he'd grown into a small man, an inch or two shorter than Catelyn, slender and quick, with the sharp features she remembered and the same laughing grey-green eyes. He had a little pointed chin beard now, and threads of silver in his dark hair, though he was still shy of 30. They went well with the silver mockingbird that fastened his cloak. Even as a child, he had always loved his silver. "How did you know I was in the city?" she asked him.
"Lord Varys knows all," Pataya said with a sly smile. "He will be joining us shortly, but I wanted to see you alone first. It's been too long, Cat. How many years?"
Catelyn ignored his familiarity. There were more important questions. "So it was the King Spider who found me."
Littlefinger winced. "You don't want to call him that. He's very sensitive. Comes of being a eunuch, I imagine. Nothing happens in the city without Varys knowing. Oftentimes he knows about it before it happens. He has informants everywhere. His little birds, he calls them. One of his little birds heard about your visit. Thankfully, Varys came to me first."
"Why you?" He shrugged.
"Why not me? I'm Master of Coin, the King's own counsellor. Selmy and Lord Renly rode north to meet Robert, and Lord Stannis has gone to Dragonstone, leaving only Maester Pycelle and me. I was the obvious choice. I was ever a friend to your sister, Lysa. Varys knows that."
"Does Varys know about—"
"Lord Varys knows everything, except why you're here."
He lifted an eyebrow.
"Why are you here?"
"A wife is allowed to yearn for her husband, and if a mother needs her daughter's close, who can tell her no?"
Littlefinger laughed. "Oh, very good, my lady, but please don't expect me to believe that. I know you too well. What were the Tully words again?"
Her throat was dry. "Family, duty, honour," she recited stiffly. He did know her too well.
"Family, duty, honour," he echoed, "all of which required you to remain in Winterfell, where our hand left you. No, my lady, something has happened. This sudden trip of yours bespeaks a certain urgency. I beg of you, let me help. Old sweet friends should never hesitate to rely upon each other."
There was a soft knock on the door.
"Enter," Littlefinger called out.
The man who stepped through the door was plump, perfumed, powdered, and as hairless as an egg. He wore a vest of woven gold thread over a loose gown of purple silk, and on his feet were pointed slippers of soft velvet.
"Lady Stark," he said, taking a hand in both of his, "to see you again after so many years. It's such a joy."
His flesh was soft and moist, and his breath smelled of lilacs.
"Oh, your poor hands. Have you burned yourself, sweet lady? The fingers are so delicate. Our good Maester Pycelle makes such a marvellous salve. Shall I send for a jar?"
Catelyn slid her fingers from his grasp. "I thank you, my lord, but my own Maester Lewin has already seen to my hurts."
Varys bobbed his head. "I was grievous sad to hear about your son, and him so young. The gods are cruel."
"On that we agree, Lord Varys," she said. The title was but a courtesy, due him as a council member. Varys was lord of nothing but the spiderweb, the master of none but his whisperers. The eunuch spread his soft hands.
"On more than that, I hope, sweet lady. I have great esteem for your husband, our new hand, and I know we do both love King Robert."
"Yes," she was forced to say, for a certainty.
"Never has a king been so beloved as our Robert,"
quipped Littlefinger. He smiled slyly. "At least in Lord Varys' hearing."
"Good lady," Varys said with great solicitude, "there are men in the Free Cities with wondrous healing powers. Say only a word, and I will send for one for your dear Bran."
"Maester Luan is doing all that can be done for Bran," she told him. She would not speak of Bran, not here, not with these men. She's trusted Littlefinger only a little, and Varys not at all. She would not let them see her grief. "Lord Baelish tells me that I have you to thank for bringing me here." Varys giggled like a little girl.
Yes, I suppose I am guilty. I hope you forgive me, kind lady."
He eased himself down into a seat and put his hands together.
"I wonder if we might trouble you to show us the dagger."
Catelyn Stark stared at the eunuch in stunned disbelief. He was a spider, she thought wildly, an enchanter, or worse. He knew things no one could possibly know, unless... "What have you done to Sir Roderick?" she demanded. Littlefinger was lost. "I feel rather like the knight who arrives at the battle without his lance. What dagger are we talking about? Who is Sir Roderick?"
"Sir Roderick Cassel is master-at-arms at Winterfell," Varys informed him. "I assure you, Lady Stark, nothing at all has been done to the good knight. He did call here early this afternoon. He visited with Sir Aaron Santigar in the armory, and they talked of a certain dagger. About sunset they left the castle together and walked to that dreadful hovel where you were staying. They are still there, drinking in the common room, waiting for your return. Sir Roderick was very distressed to find you gone."
"How could you know all that?"
"Oh, the whisperings of little birds," Varys said, smiling. "I know things, sweet lady. That is the nature of my service." He shrugged. "You do have the dagger with you, yes?"
Catelyn pulled it out from beneath her cloak and threw it down on the table in front of him. "Here, perhaps your little birds will whisper the name of the man it belongs to." Varys lifted the knife with exaggerated delicacy and ran a thumb along its edge. Blood welled, and he let out a squeal and dropped the dagger back on the table. "Careful," Catelyn told him. "It's sharp." "Nothing holds an edge like Valyrian steel," Littlefinger said, as Varys sucked at his bleeding thumb and looked at Catelyn with sullen admonition. Littlefinger hefted the knife lightly in his hand, testing the grip. He flipped it in the air, caught it again with his other hand. Such sweet balance. "You want to find the owner. Is that the reason for this visit?" "You have no need of Sir Aaron for that, my lady. You should have come to me." "And if I had," she said, "what would you have told me?" "I would have told you that there was only one knife like this at King's Landing." He grasped the blade between thumb and forefinger, drew it back over his shoulder, and threw it across the room with a practiced flick of his wrist. It struck the door and buried itself deep in the oak, quivering. "It's mine."
"Yours?"
It made no sense. Pataya had not been at Winterfell. "Until the tourney on Prince Joffrey's name day," he said, crossing the room to wrench the dagger from the wood. "I back Sir Jaime in the jousting, along with half the court." Pataya's sheepish grin made him look half a boy again. "When Loras Tyrell unhorsed him, many of us became a trifle poorer. Sir Jaime lost 100 golden dragons. The Queen lost an emerald pendant, and I lost my knife. Her Grace got the emerald back, but the winner kept the rest."
"Who?"
Catelyn demanded, her mouth dry with fear. Her fingers ached with remembered pain. "The imp," said Littlefinger, as Lord Varys watched her face. "Tyrion Lannister." Samwell. Sobbing, Sam took another step.
"Yes, as a last one. The very last. I can't go on. I can't.
But his feet moved again. One, and then the other. They took a step, then another, and he thought,
they're not my feet. They're someone else's. Someone else is walking. It can't be me.
When he looked down, he could see them stumbling through the snow, shapeless things and clumsy. His boots had been black, he seemed to remember. But the snow had caked around them, and now they were misshapen white balls, like two club feet made of ice. It would not stop, the snow. The drifts were up past his knees, and a crust covered his lower legs like a pair of white greaves. His steps were dragging, lurching. The heavy pack he carried made him look like some monstrous hunchback. And he was tired,
so tired. I can't go on. Mother, have mercy, I can't.
Every fourth or fifth step, he had to reach down and tug up his sword belt. He had lost the sword on the fist, but the scabbard still weighed down the belt. He did have two knives, the dragonglass dagger John had given him, and the steel one he cut his meat with. All that weight dragged heavy, and his belly was so big and round that if he forgot to tug, the belt slipped right off and tangled round his ankles, no matter how tight he cinched it. He had tried belting it above his belly once, but then it almost came to his armpits. Gren had laughed himself sick at the sight of it, and Dolorous Ed had said, "I knew a man once, eh, who wore his sword on a chain around his neck like that. One day he stumbled, eh, and the hilt went up his nose, eh?" Sam was stumbling himself. There were rocks beneath the snow, and the roots of trees, and sometimes deep holes in the frozen ground. Black Bernard had stepped in one and broken his ankle 3 days past, or maybe four, or he did not know how long it had been, truly. The Lord Commander had put Bernard on a horse after that. Sobbing, Sam took another step. It felt more like he was falling down than walking, falling endlessly, but never hitting the ground, just falling forward and forward.
"I have to stop. It hurts too much. I'm so cold and tired. I need to sleep. Just a little sleep beside a fire and a bite to eat that isn't frozen."
But if he stopped, he died. He knew that. They all knew that, the few who were left. They had been 50 when they fled the fist, maybe more, but some had wandered off in the snow. A few wounded had bled to death. And sometimes Sam heard shouts behind him from the rear guard, and once an awful scream. When he heard that, he had run 20 yards or 30, as fast and as far as he could, his half-frozen feet kicking up the snow. He would be running still if his legs were stronger.
"They are behind us. They are still behind us. They are taking us one by one."
Sobbing, Sam took another step. He had been cold so long he was forgetting what it was like to feel warm. He wore 3 pairs of hose, 2 layers of small clothes, beneath a double lamb's wool tunic, and over that a thick quilted coat that padded him against the cold steel of his chainmail. Over the hauberk he had a loose surcoat. Over that, a triple-thick cloak with a bone button that fastened tight under his chins. Its hood flopped forward over his forehead. Heavy fur mitts covered his hands over thin wool and leather gloves. A scarf was wrapped snugly about the lower half of his face, and he had a tight-fitting fleece-lined cap pulled down over his ears beneath the hood, and still the cold was in him. His feet, especially. He couldn't even feel them now, but only yesterday they had hurt so bad he could hardly bear to stand on them, let alone walk. Every step made him want to scream. Was that yesterday? He could not remember. He had not slept since the fist, not once since the horn had blown, unless it was while he was walking. Could a man walk while he was sleeping? Sam did not know, or else he had forgotten. Sobbing, he took another step. The snow swirled down around him. Sometimes it fell from a white sky and sometimes from a black. But that was all that remained of day and night. He wore it on his shoulders like a second cloak, and it piled up high atop the pack he carried and made it even heavier and harder to bear. The small of his back hurt abominably, as if someone had shoved a knife in there and was wiggling it back and forth with every step. His shoulders were in agony from the weight of the mail. He would have given almost anything to take it off, but he was afraid to. Anyway, he would have needed to remove his cloak and surcoat to get at it, and then the cold would have him.
"If only I was stronger."
He wasn't, though, and it was no good wishing. Sam was weak and fat, so very fat he could hardly bear his own weight. The mail was much too much for him. It felt as though it was rubbing his shoulders raw, despite the layers of cloth and quilt between the steel and skin. The only thing he could do was cry, and when he cried, the tears froze on his cheeks. Sobbing, he took another step. The crust was broken where he set his feet. Otherwise, he did not think he could have moved at all. Off to the left and right, half seen through the silent trees, torches turned to vague orange halos in the falling snow. When he turned his head, he could see them, slipping silent through the wood, bobbing up and down and back and forth.
"The old bear's ring of fire," he reminded himself, "and woe to him who leaves it."
As he walked, it seemed as if he were chasing the torches ahead of him. But they had legs as well, longer and stronger than his, so he could never catch them. Yesterday he begged for them to let him be one of the torchbearers, even if it meant walking outside of the column with the darkness pressing close. He wanted the fire, dreamed of the fire.
"If I had the fire, I would not be cold."
But someone reminded him that he'd had a torch at the start, but he'd dropped it in the snow and snuffed the fire out. Sam didn't remember dropping any torch, but he supposed it was true. He was too weak to hold his arm up for long. Was it Ed who reminded him about the torch, or Gren? He couldn't remember that either.
"Fat and weak and useless. Even my wits are freezing now."
He took another step. He had wrapped his scarf over his nose and mouth, but it was covered with snot now, and so stiff he feared it must be frozen to his face. Even breathing was hard, and the air was so cold it hurt to swallow it.
"Mother, have mercy,"
he muttered in a hushed, husky voice beneath the frozen mask.
"Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy."
With each prayer he took another step, dragging his legs through the snow.
"Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy. Mother, have mercy."
His own mother was 1,000 leagues south, safe with his sisters and his little brother Dickon in the keep at Horn Hill.
"She can't hear me, no more than the mother above."
The mother was merciful, all the Septons agreed, but the Seven had no power beyond the wall. This was where the old gods ruled, the nameless gods of the trees and the wolves and the snow.
"Mercy,"
he whispered then, to whatever might be listening, old gods or new, or demons too.
"Oh, mercy, mercy me, mercy me."
Massin screamed for mercy.
Why had he suddenly remembered that? It was nothing he wanted to remember. The man had stumbled backward, dropping his sword, pleading, yielding, even yanking off his thick black glove and thrusting it up before him, as if it were a gauntlet. He was still shrieking for quarter as the white lifted him in the air by the throat and near ripped the head off him.
"The dead have no mercy left in them. And the others, oh no, I mustn't think of that. Don't think, don't remember, just walk, just walk, just walk."
Sobbing, he took another step. A root beneath the crust caught his toe, and Sam tripped and fell heavily to one knee, so hard he bit his tongue. He could taste the blood in his mouth, warmer than anything he'd tasted since the fist.
"This is the end," he thought.
Now that he had fallen, he could not seem to find the strength to rise again. He groped for a tree branch and clutched it tight, trying to pull himself back to his feet, but his stiff legs would not support him. The mail was too heavy, and he was too fat besides, and too weak, and too tired.
"Back on your feet, piggy,"
someone growled as he went past, but Sam paid him no mind.
"I'll just lie down in the snow and close my eyes."
It wouldn't be so bad, dying here. He couldn't possibly be any colder, and after a little while he wouldn't be able to feel the ache in his lower back or the terrible pain in his shoulders, no more than he could his feet.
"I won't be the first to die. They can't say I was."
Hundreds had died on the fist. They had died all around him, and more had died after. He'd seen them. Shivering, Sam released his grip on the tree and eased himself down into the snow. It was cold and wet, he knew, but he could scarcely feel it through all his clothing. He stared upward at the pale white sky as snowflakes drifted down upon his stomach and his chest and his eyelids.
"The snow will cover me like a thick white blanket. It will be warm under the snow, and if they speak of me, they will have to say I died a man of the night's watch. I did. I did my duty. No one could say I forswore myself. I'm fat, and I'm weak, and I'm craven, but I did my duty."
The ravens had been his responsibility. That was why they had brought him along. He hadn't wanted to go. He'd told them so. He'd told them all what a big coward he was. But Maester Aemon was very old and blind besides. So they had had to send Sam to tend the ravens. The Lord Commander had given him his orders when they made their camp on the fist.
"You're no fighter. We both know that, boy. If it happens that we're attacked, don't go trying to prove otherwise. You'll just get in the way. You're to send a message, and don't come running to ask what the letter should say. Write it out yourself, and send one bird to Castle Black and another to the Shadow Tower."
The old bear pointed a gloved finger right in Sam's face.
"I don't care if you're so scared you foul your breeches. And I don't care if 1,000 wildlings are coming over the walls howling for your blood. You get those birds off, or I swear I'll hunt you through all 7 hells and make you damn sorry that you didn't."
And Mormont's own raven had bobbed its head up and down and croaked,
"Sorry! Sorry! Sorry!"
Sam was sorry. Sorry he hadn't been braver, or stronger, or good with swords, that he hadn't been a better son to his father, and a better brother to Dickon and the girls. He was sorry to die, too, but better men had died on the fist, good men and true, not squeaking fat boys like him. At least he would not have the old bear hunting him through hell, though.
"I got the birds off. I did that right, at least."
He had written out the messages ahead of time, short messages and simple, telling of an attack on the fist of the first men, and then he had tucked them away safe in his parchment pouch, hoping he would never need to send them. When the horns blew, Sam had been sleeping. He thought he was dreaming them at first, but when he opened his eyes, snow was falling on the camp, and the Black Brothers were all grabbing bows and spears and running towards the ring wall. Chet was the only one nearby. Maester Aemon's old steward, with his face full of boils and the big wen on his neck. Sam had never seen so much fear on a man's face as he saw on Chet's when that third blast came moaning through the trees.
"Help me get the birds off,"
he pleaded, but the other steward had turned and run off, dagger in hand.
"He has the dogs to care for," Sam remembered.
Probably the Lord Commander had given him some orders as well. His fingers had been so stiff and clumsy in the gloves, and he was shaking from fear and cold, but he found the parchment pouch and dug out the messages he'd written. The ravens were shrieking furiously, and when he opened the castle black cage, one of them flew right in his face. Two more escaped before Sam could catch one, and when he did, it pecked him through his glove, drawing blood. Yet somehow he held on long enough to attach the little roll of parchment. The war horn had fallen silent by then, but the fist rang with shouted commands and the clatter of steel.
"Fly!"
Sam called as he tossed the raven into the air. The birds in the Shadow Tower cage were screaming and fluttering about so madly that he was afraid to open the door, but he made himself do it anyway. This time he caught the first raven that tried to escape. A moment later, it was clawing its way up through the falling snow, bearing word of the attack. His duty done, he finished dressing with clumsy, frightened fingers, donning his cap and surcoat and hooded cloak, and buckling on his sword belt, buckling it real tight so it wouldn't fall down. Then he found his pack and stuffed all his things inside, spare small clothes and dry socks, the dragon glass arrowheads and spearhead John had given him, and the old horn too, his parchments, inks and quills, the maps he'd been drawing, and a rock-hard garlic sausage he'd been saving since the war. He tied it all up and shouldered the pack onto his back. "The Lord Commander said I wasn't to rush to the ring wall," he recalled, "but he said I shouldn't come running to him either." Sam took a deep breath and realized that he did not know what to do next. He remembered turning in a circle, lost, the fear growing inside him as it always did. There were dogs barking and horses trumpeting, but the snow muffled the sounds and made them seem far away. Sam could see nothing beyond 3 yards, not even the torches burning along the low stone wall that ringed the crown of the hill. Could the torches have gone out? That was too scary to think about. The horn blew thrice long. 3 long blasts means others. The white walkers of the wood, the cold shadows, the monsters of the tales that made him squeak and tremble as a boy, riding their giant ice spiders, hungry for blood. Awkwardly, he drew his sword and plodded heavily through the snow, holding it. A dog ran past, barking, and he saw some of the men from the Shadow Tower, big bearded men with long axes and 8-foot spears. He felt safer for their company, so he followed them to the wall. When he saw the torches still burning atop the ring of stones, a shudder of relief went through him. The Black Brother stood with swords and spears in hand, watching the snowfall, waiting. Sir Malador Locke went by on his horse, wearing a snow-speckled helm. Sam stood well back behind the others, looking for Gren or Dolorous Ed.
"If I have to die, let me die beside my friends," he remembered thinking.
But all the men around him were strangers, Shadow Tower men, under the command of the ranger named Blaine.
"Here they come," he heard a brother say.
"Notch," said Blaine, and 20 black arrows were pulled from as many quivers and notched to as many bowstrings.
"Gods be good, there's hundreds,"
a voice said softly.
"Draw,"
Blaine said, and then,
"Hold!"
Sam could not see and did not want to see. The men of the Night's Watch stood behind their torches, waiting, with arrows pulled back to their ears, as something came up that dark, slippery slope through the snow.
"Hold!"
Blaine said again.
"Hold! Hold!"
And then,
"Loose!"
The arrows whispered as they flew. A ragged cheer went up from the men along the ring wall, but it died quickly.
"They're not stopping, my lord,"
a man said to Blaine, and another shouted,
"More, look there, coming from the trees,"
and yet another said,
"Gods of mercy, they's crawling, they's almost here, they're on us."
Sam had been backing away by then, shaking like the last leaf on the tree when the wind kicks up, as much as from cold as from fear. It had been very cold that night.
"Even colder than now. The snow seems almost warm. I feel better now. A little rest was all I needed. Maybe in a little while I'll be strong enough to walk again. In a little while.
A horse stepped past his head, a shaggy grey beast with snow in its mane and hooves crusted with ice. Sam watched it come and watched it go.
Another appeared from out of the falling snow, with a man in black leading it. When he saw Sam in his path, he cursed him and led the horse around.
"I wish I had a horse," he thought. "If I had a horse, I could keep going. I could sit, and even sleep some in the saddle."
Most of their mounts had been lost at the fist, though, and those that remained carried their food, their torches, and their wounded. Sam wasn't wounded.
"Only fat and weak, and the greatest craven in the Seven Kingdoms." He was such a coward.
Lord Randall, his father, had always said so, and he had been right. Sam was his heir, but he had never been worthy, so his father had sent him away to the wall. His little brother Dickon would inherit the Tarley lands and castle and the great sword, Heartsbane, that the lords of Hornhill had borne so proudly for centuries. He wondered whether Dickon would shed a tear for his brother, who died in the snow, somewhere off beyond the edge of the world.
Why should he? A coward's not worth weeping over.
He had heard his father tell his mother as much 50 times. The old bear knew it too.
"Fire arrows!"
the Lord Commander roared that night on the fist, when he appeared suddenly astride his horse.
"Give them flame!"
It was then he noticed Sam there quaking.
"Tarley, get out of here. Your place is with the ravens."
I got the messages away."
"Good."
On Mormont's shoulder, his own raven echoed,
"Good, good."
The Lord Commander looked huge in fur and mail. Behind his black iron visor, his eyes were fierce.
"You're in the way here. Go back to your cadres. If I need to send another message, I don't want to have to find you first. See that the birds are ready."
He did not wait for a response, but turned his horse and trotted around the ring, shouting,
"Fire! Give them fire!"
Sam did not need to be told twice. He went back to the birds as fast as his fat legs could carry him.
"I should write the message ahead of time," he thought, "so we can get the birds away as fast as needs be."
It took him longer than it should have to light his little fire to warm the frozen ink. He sat beside it on a rock with quill and parchment and wrote his messages.
"Attacked amidst snow and cold, but we've thrown them back with fire arrows," he wrote,
as he heard Thorin Smallwood's voice ring out with a command of,
"Notch! Draw! Loose!"
The flight of arrows made a sound as sweet as a mother's prayer.
"Burn, you dead bastards, burn!"
Dywin sang out, cackling. The brothers cheered and cursed.
"All safe," he wrote. "We remain on the fist of the first men."
Sam hoped they were better archers than him. He put that note aside and found another blank parchment.
"Still fighting on the fist amidst heavy snows," he wrote when someone shouted,
"They're still coming!
Result uncertain."
"Spears!"
someone said. It might have been Sir Malador, but Sam could not swear to it.
"Whites attacked us on the fist in snow," he wrote, "but we drove them off with fire."
He turned his head. Through the drifting snow, all he could see was the huge fire at the center of the camp, with mounted men moving restlessly around it. The reserve, he knew, ready to ride down anything that breached the ring wall. They had armed themselves with torches in place of swords, and were lighting them in the flames.
"Whites all around us," he wrote, when he heard the shouts from the north face, "coming up from north and south at once. Spears and swords don't stop them, only fire."
"Loose! Loose! Loose!"
A voice screamed in the night, and another shouted,
"Bloody huge!"
And a third said,
"A giant!"
And a fourth insisted,
"A bear! A bear!"
A horse shrieked,
and the hounds began to bay, and there was so much shouting that Sam couldn't make out the voices any more. He wrote faster, note after note. "Dead wildings and a giant or maybe a bear on us all around." He heard the crash of steel on wood, which could only mean one thing. "Whites over the ring wall, fighting inside the camp." A dozen mounted brothers pounded past him toward the east wall, burning brands streaming flames in each rider's hand.
"Lord Commander Mormont is meeting them with fire. We've won. We're winning. We're holding our own. We're cutting our way free and retreating for the wall. We're trapped on the fist. Hard pressed."
One of the Shadow Tower men came staggering out of the darkness to fall at Sam's feet. He crawled within a foot of the fire before he died.
"Lost," Sam wrote. "The battle's lost. We're all lost."
Why must he remember the fight at the fist? He didn't want to remember. Not that. He tried to make himself remember his mother, or his little sister Tala, or that girl Gilly at Craster's Keep. Someone was shaking him by the shoulder.
"Get up," a voice said. "Sam, you can't go to sleep here. Get up and keep walking." "I wasn't asleep. I was remembering." "Go away," he said, his words frosting in the cold air. "I'm well. I want a rest."
"Get up,"
Gren's voice, harsh and husky. He loomed over Sam, his blacks crusty with snow.
"There's no resting. The old bear said, you'll die."
"Gran," he smiled. "No, truly, I'm good here. You just go on. I'll catch you after I've rested a bit longer."
"You won't."
Gren's thick brown beard was frozen all around his mouth. It made him look like some old man.
"You'll freeze, or the others will get you, Sam. Get up."
The night before they left the wall, Pip had teased Gren the way he did, Sam remembered, smiling and saying how Gren was a good choice for the ranging, since he was too stupid to be terrified. Gren hotly denied it until he realized what he was saying. He was stocky and thick-necked and strong. Sir Alistair Thorne had called him Oryx, the same way he called Sam Sir Piggy, and John Lord Snow. But he had always treated Sam nice enough.
That was only because of John, though. If it weren't for John, none of them would have liked me.
And now John was gone, lost in the Skirling Pass, with Corran Halfhand, most likely dead. Sam would have cried for him, but those tears would only freeze as well, and he could scarcely keep his eyes open now. A tall brother with a torch stopped beside them, and for a wonderful moment Sam felt the warmth on his face.
"Leave him," the man said to Gren. "If they can't walk, they're done. Save your strength for yourself, Gren."
"He'll get up," Gren replied. "He only needs a hand."
The man moved on, taking the blessed warmth with him. Gren tried to pull Sam to his feet.
"That hurts," he complained. "Stop it, Gren. You're hurting my arm. Stop it. You're too bloody heavy."
Gren jammed his hands into Sam's armpits, gave a grunt, and held him upright. But the moment he let go, the fat boy sat back down in the snow. Gren kicked him, a solid thump that cracked the crust of snow around his boot and sent it flying everywhere.
"Get up!"
He kicked him again.
"Get up and walk! You have to walk!"
Sam fell over sideways, curling up into a tight ball to protect himself from the kicks. He hardly felt them through all his wool and leather and mail, but even so, they hurt.
"I thought Gren was my friend. You shouldn't kick your friends. Why won't they let me be? I just need to rest, that's all. To rest and sleep some, and maybe die a little."
"If you take the torch, I can take the fat boy."
Suddenly, he was jerked up into the cold air, away from his sweet, soft snow. He was floating. There was an arm under his knees and another under his back. Sam raised his head and blinked. A face loomed close, a broad, brutal face with a flat nose and small dark eyes and a thicket of coarse brown beard. He had seen the face before, but it took him a moment to remember. Paul! Small Paul! Melting ice ran down into his eyes from the heat of the torch. "Can you carry him?" he heard Gren ask.
"I carried a calf once. Was heavier than him. I carried him down to his mother so he could get a drink of milk."
Sam's head bobbed up and down with every step that Small Paul took.
"Stop it," he murmured. "Put me down. I'm not a baby. I'm a man of the night's watch," he sobbed. "Just let me die."
"Be quiet, Sam," said Gren. "Save your strength. Think about your sisters and brother. Maester Aemon, your favourite foods. Sing a song if you like."
"Aloud?"
"In your head."
Sam knew 100 songs, but when he tried to think of one, he couldn't. The words had all gone from his head. He sobbed again and said,
"I don't know any songs, Gren. I did know some, but now I don't."
"Yes, you do," said Gren. "How about The Bear and the Maiden Fair? Everyone knows that one."
"A bear there was, a bear all black and brown and covered with hair." "No, not that one," Sam pleaded.
The bear that had come up the fist had no hair left on its rotted flesh. He didn't want to think about bears.
"No songs, please, Gren. Think about your ravens, then. They were never mine."
"They were the Lord Commander's ravens, the ravens of the Night's Watch. They belonged to Castle Black and the Shadow Tower." Small Paul frowned.
"Chet said I could have the old bear's raven, the one that talks. I save food for it and everything."
He shook his head.
"I forgot, though. I left the food where I hid it."
He plodded onward, pale white breath coming from his mouth with every step. Then suddenly said,
"Could I have one of your ravens? Just the one? I'd never let Lark eat it."
"They're gone," said Sam. "I'm sorry. So sorry. They're flying back to the wall now."
He had set the birds free when he'd heard the war horn sound once more, calling the watch to horse.
2 short blasts and a long one. That was a call to mount up.
But there was no reason to mount, unless to abandon the fist, and that meant the battle was lost. The fear bit him so strong then that it was all Sam could do to open the cages. Only as he watched the last raven flap up into the snowstorm did he realize that he had forgotten to send any of the messages he'd written.
"No!" he squealed. "Oh, no! Oh, no!"
The snow fell, and the horns blew, "Ahoo! Ahoo! Ahoo!" they cried. "Torse! Torse! Torse!" Sam saw 2 ravens perched on a rock and ran after them, but the birds flapped off lazily through the swirling snow in opposite directions. He chased one, his breath puffing out of his nose in thick white clouds, stumbled, and found himself 10 feet from the ring wall. After that, he remembered the dead coming over the stones with arrows in their faces and through their throats. Some were all in ringmail, and some were almost naked. Wildlings, most of them, but a few wore faded blacks. He remembered one of the Shadow Tower men shoving his spear through a white's pale, soft belly and out his back, and how the thing staggered right up the shaft and reached out his black hands and twisted the brother's head around until blood came out of his mouth. That was when his bladder let go the first time. He was almost sure. He did not remember running, but he must have, because the next he knew he was near the fire, half a camp away, with old Sir Otten Withers and some archers. Sir Otten was on his knees in the snow, staring at the chaos around them, until a riderless horse came by and kicked him in the face. The archers paid him no mind. They were loosing fire arrows at shadows in the dark. Sam saw one white hit, saw the flames engulf it, but there were 12 more behind it, and a huge pale shape that must have been the bear. and soon enough the bowman had no arrows. And then Sam found himself on a horse. It wasn't his own horse, and he never recalled mounting up either. Maybe it was the horse that had smashed the Otten's face in. The horns were still blowing, so he kicked the horse and turned him toward the sound. In the midst of carnage and chaos and blowing snow, he found Dolorous Ed sitting on his garron with a plain black banner on a spear.
"Sam," Ed said when he saw him, "Cor, would you wake me, please, eh? I am having this terrible nightmare."
More men were mounting up every moment. The war horns called them back. "Ahoo! Ahoo! Ahoo!"
"They're over the west wall, my lord," Thorin Smallwood screamed at the old bear as he fought to control his horse. "I'll send reserves."
"No!"
Mormont had to bellow at the top of his lungs to be heard over the horns.
"Call them back! We'll have to cut our way out!"
He stood in his stirrups, his black cloak snapping in the wind, the fire shining off his armour.
"Spearhead!" he roared. "Form wedge! We ride! Down the south face, then east!"
"My lord, the south slope's crawling with them."
"The others are too steep," Mormont said. "We have—"
His garron screamed and reared and almost threw him as the bear came staggering through the snow. Sam pissed himself all over again.
"I didn't think I had any more left inside me."
The bear was dead, pale and rotting, its fur and skin all sloughed off and half its right arm burned to the bone. Yet still it came on. Only its eyes lived.
Bright blue, just as John said.
They shone like frozen stars. Thorin Smallwood charged, his longsword shining all orange and red from the light of the fire. His swing nearly took the bear's head off. And then the bear took his.
"Ride!"
the Lord Commander shouted, wheeling. They were at the gallop by the time they reached the ring. Sam had always been too frightened to jump a horse before, but when the low stone wall loomed up before him, he knew he had no choice. He kicked and closed his eyes and whimpered, and the garron took him over, somehow. Somehow, the garron took him over. The rider to his right came crashing down in a tangle of steel and leather and screaming horseflesh, and then the whites were swarming over him, and the wedge was closing up. They plunged down the hillside at a run, through clutching black hands and burning blue eyes and blowing snow. Horses stumbled and rolled. Men were swept from their saddles. Torches spun through the air. Axes and swords hacked to dead flesh. And Samwell Tarly sobbed, clutching desperately to his horse with a strength he never knew he had. He was in the middle of a flying spearhead with brothers on either side and before and behind him as well. A dog ran with them for a ways, bounding down the snowy slope and in and out among the horses, but he could not keep up. The whites stood their ground and were ridden down and trampled underfoot. Even as they fell, they clutched swords and stirrups and the legs of passing horses. Sam saw one claw open a garron's belly with its right hand while it clung to the saddle with its left. Suddenly the trees were all about them, and Sam was splashing through a frozen stream with the sounds of slaughter dwindling behind. He turned, breathless with relief, until a man in black leapt from the bush and yanked him out of the saddle. Who he was, Sam never saw. He was up in an instant and galloping away the next. When he tried to run after the horse, his feet tangled in a root and he fell hard on his face and lay weeping like a baby until Dolorous Ed found him there. That was his last coherent memory of the Fist of the First Men. Later, hours later, he stood shivering among the other survivors, half-mounted and half-afoot. They were miles from the Fist by then, though Sam did not remember how. Dywin had led down 5 pack-horses, heavy laden with food and oil and torches, and 3 had made it thus far. The old bear had made them redistribute the loads, so the loss of any one horse and its provisions would not be such a catastrophe. He took garrons from the healthy men and gave them to the wounded.
organize the walkers, and set torches to guard their flanks and rear. All I need to do is walk, Sam told himself, as he took that first step toward home. But before an hour was gone, he had begun to struggle and to lag. They were lagging now as well, he saw. He remembered Pip saying once how small Paul was the strongest man in the watch. He must be to carry me. Yet even so, the snow was growing deeper, the ground more treacherous, and Paul's strides had begun to shorten. More horsemen passed, wounded men who looked at Sam with dull, incurious eyes. Some torchbearers went by as well. "You're falling behind," one told them. The next agreed. "No one's like to wait for you, Paul. Leave the pig for the dead men."
"He promised I could have a bird," Small Paul said, even though Sam hadn't, not truly. "They aren't mine to give. I want me a bird that talks and eats corn from my hand." "Bloody fool," the torchman said. Then he was gone.
It was a while after when Gren stopped suddenly.
"We're alone," he said in a hoarse voice. "I can't see the other torches. Was that the rear guard?"
Small Paul had no answer for him. The big man gave a grunt and sank to his knees. His arms trembled as he lay Sam gently in the snow.
"I can't carry you no more. I would, but I can't."
He shivered violently. The wind sighed through the trees, driving a fine spray of snow into their faces. The cold was so bitter that Sam felt naked. He looked for the other torches, but they were gone, every one of them. There was only the one Gren carried, the flames rising from it like pale orange silks. He could see through them, to the black beyond. "That torch will burn out soon," he thought, "and we are all alone, without food or friends or fire."
But that was wrong. They weren't alone at all.
The lower branches of the great green sentinel shed their burden of snow with a soft, wet plop. Gren spun, thrusting out his torch.
Who goes there?
A horse's head emerged from the darkness. Sam felt a moment's relief until he saw the horse. Hoarfrost covered it like a sheen of frozen sweat, and a nest of stiff black entrails dragged from its open belly. On its back was a rider, pale as ice. Sam made a whimpery sound deep in his throat. He was so scared he might have pissed himself all over again, but the cold was in him, a cold so savage that his bladder felt frozen solid. The other slid gracefully from the saddle to stand upon the snow. Sword slim it was, and milky white. Its armor rippled and shifted as it moved, and its feet did not break the crust of the new-fallen snow. Small Paul unslung the long-hafted axe strapped across his back.
"Why'd you hurt that horse? That was Morney's horse."
Sam groped for the hilt of his sword, but the scabbard was empty. He had lost it on the fist, he remembered too late.
"Get away!"
Gren took a step, thrusting the torch out before him. "Away, or you burn!" He poked at it with the flames. The other's sword gleamed with a faint blue glow. It moved toward Gren, lightning quick, slashing. When the ice-blue blade brushed the flames, a screech stabbed Sam's ears sharp as a needle. The head of the torch tumbled sideways to vanish beneath a deep drift of snow. The fire snuffed out at once. And all Gren held was a short wooden stick. He flung it at the other, cursing, as Small Paul charged in with his axe. The fear that filled Sam then was worse than any fear he'd ever felt before, and Samuel Tarley knew every kind of fear.
"Mother, have mercy!" he wept, forgetting the old gods in his terror. "Father, protect me! Oh, oh!"
His fingers found his dagger, and he filled his hand with that. The whites had been slow, clumsy things, but the other was light as snow on the wind. It slid away from Paul's axe, armour rippling, and its crystal sword